All right, it looks like we do want to start early if everyone's on board. So Marshall, if you want to start us off.
Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Smith, Chief Judge Siegel, and Judge Hal Brooks. The Honorable Tracy M. Smith presiding.
Thank you. Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We're here for our fourth and final argument this morning. The case is A21-0302. In re the Guardianship and Conservatorship of Olga Z. Chorolik. Great. Counsel, each of you has 15 minutes for your principal arguments. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes rebuttal if you choose to use that. So at the start of each of your principal arguments, counsel, if you could please state your full name and the party you represent for the record. We are ready to go with counsel for appellant.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Benjamin Letcher with the Ferdinand Peters Law Firm in St. Paul, and I represent the objector, Helen Chorolik. And without meaning to be rude in any way, because everyone has the same last names, Olga Chorolik, this is a guardian and conservatorship matter, is the protected person. And then her two daughters are the other two principal actors, my client, Helen Chorolik, and then Ms. Mohaber's client, Lily Chorolik. And so if I may, I will refer to them by their first name without meaning disrespect. But you know, there has been significant briefing. This is a contentious case with a large district court file that goes back some time. Lily Chorolik is the conservator. And at this point in time, while my client and Lily Chorolik shared guardianship duties in the past, my client is only an objector. And for all the mess that there is at the trial court level, I think that the issue that's being principally presented here today is fairly simple, and that's the jurisdictional argument with respect to the summons, complaint, and motion for partition, which were all filed in this action by Lily Chorolik in January of 2021. And in response to that, my office, Patrick Kennedy, who appears to be observing but is no longer with my office, was handling the matter at that time. And I have looked at the record and reviewed things, but based on the record, as the court will see, a motion was filed to strike all of those documents, which were filed as improper documents in the case. They were all served and filed 21 days before they were served 20 days before, but it's really immaterial, shortly before a hearing on the motion to amend findings. And the argument that that we're presenting here again today, in which the court rejected in its order of February 22nd of 2021, is that the only proper way for the court to obtain jurisdiction over an action for partition under Chapter 558 of the Minnesota statutes would be to commence a separate action. And, you know, theoretically, under the rules, you know, that could be consolidated with a motion to the chief judge under the general rules. But the essence of the issue is that this case has been very complicated and contentious. And all that we were wanting to ensure in this case was that if there is going to be a partition action which affects the interests of Olga and Helen, who are each 50% owners as tenants in common of the homestead, which they shared for a period of time and which is now vacant, that it be done properly and with a proper exercise of jurisdiction. The court cited two cases principally in determining that it could exercise jurisdiction, and that's the unpublished RIJ revocable trust agreement case, and this was cited in the briefs, and then also the estate of Sangren case. And respectfully, the estate of Sangren case, I think, clearly shows that there is no jurisdiction in this case. And that case properly points out that when a court is looking to determine whether or not it has jurisdiction, the main way is that it goes and looks at the statutes. And as in the Sangren case, when determining whether there was a jurisdiction over a collateral matter, the court looked to the probate code, chapter 524, and based on analyzing the provisions which were applicable to that type of action, a trust or a state case not involving guardianship or conservatorship, it went to those jurisdiction provisions of chapter 524 and found that it did have jurisdiction. Here, the applicable provisions would be 524 5-106, and that says this article applies to and the court has jurisdiction over guardianship and related proceedings and property coming into control of a guardian or conservator. And so the way that
I do want to hear from you on that, but I just want to step back for a second. The other cases that you're talking about, was that because in this case there are actually two separate complaints filed, right? There's a second complaint brought that then is brought within this file, which is maybe different from those other cases, but you can tell me if I'm wrong. But I think the argument, you can use the word jurisdiction, maybe we have used it, but whether it's within the scope of the authority under the probate statutes to actually address the subject area of that is the second complaint, as I'm understanding it, whether it's outside the jurisdiction or outside the authority of the district court acting as a probate court. But if they could be brought together, if they both are separate actions, that the problem was bringing it within this action, but there's service and it's filed and the district court doesn't get its filing fee and it didn't have the opportunity to assign a different judge, is it a harmless error? For the other side, I guess I'd want to know, how would someone show whether it's harmless or not if it's actually a mistake, if it is outside the scope of authority? But and this makes it a little bit different, I would think, from the other cases where there's actually two actions filed. It's just that it's one nestled within the other.
Thank you, Your Honor, and I appreciate the question. I've looked, but that there's any case that I've ever that there has been in Minnesota where somebody brought a new summons and complaint within a civil action, because the rules are clear, and that's why we have rules, so that we all know where we stand and where our footing is, and that's why we can't create jurisdiction where it doesn't exist, because everything just becomes uncertain and more.
Yeah, I'm sorry, but isn't it really a procedural problem with the case caption and whether the court got an additional filing fee or not? I mean, and not really subject matter jurisdiction.
Well, I guess, Your
Honor. Go ahead.
I guess I would look at it as, by analogy to another, like if you just had a simple contract case and the rules say you get to have a complaint and an answer and a reply, if any, and no other pleadings are permitted. And so if you then you can bring a third party complaint. There are various rules that you can use to bring within the court's jurisdiction additional matters by employing those rules. And if you don't employ those rules properly to bring something into the court's jurisdiction, then the court doesn't have that jurisdiction. And if you were to bring a negligence action without seeking to amend or using one of the rules properly, the court would have no ability to assume jurisdiction. So yes, it's a procedural issue in the way that it was filed and brought into the case. But because there is no rule which permits an additional separate action to simply be brought into a case, the court had no way to assume jurisdiction unless the court otherwise had jurisdiction. And that's those cases which are pretty clear that I just referred to, which show that in other areas of the probate court, a probate court has wider jurisdiction. But in the case of a guardian, and when a court is exercising jurisdiction pursuant to a petition filed in a guardianship and conservatorship case, it doesn't have jurisdiction to simply address an action involving a property interest of a third party.
Interrupt just in the interest of time?
Yeah.
So if this had been separately captioned and it was served on your client, I think there's no dispute over that, it would be in front of a district court judge. And in fact, it could be consolidated in front of this same district court judge, correct? I mean, there's no problem there. You aren't contending that somehow or another, you know, because of, at any rate, let's keep moving on. But so how was your client's substantial rights impacted? So let's assume, you know, this was a procedural error, it's a defect. The rules tell us then there has to be some kind of substantial right impacted. And you talked about, you know, the right to serve an answer, but in fact, the district court provided for that and allowed additional time for your client to serve an answer. And the court in its order, I mean, clarified that your client would be afforded the same rights as she would if the action were filed separately, and the court will apply the law applicable to a partition action. So going to that issue of substantial rights, what substantial rights were impacted?
Thank you, Your Honor. I think the main issue is that it becomes the if you see the record below, obviously it's contentious. There's been a motion to disqualify filed, and there was you know, significant, if you read the record, the judge was very, you know, frustrated with the presentation from my client's side. And frankly, the rules would permit my client, and the opposing counsel says it's judge shopping, and very well the case might end up before this court again. But to me, there are rules in place for a reason on how you bring actions and on how they unfold. And here, the court is now then going to be exercising jurisdiction not pursuant to proper procedural mechanisms, but through just sort of saying, you know, this is the easy way to approach it, and let's just do it that way, even though the rules don't provide for it. And in doing so, then all of a sudden, my client's one-half interest in a piece of real estate of valuable real estate, which has been appraised at $200,000 or more, is all of a sudden, under the jurisdiction of the court, and that creates a risk that what I think my client's main concern is what the court is going to do is just assume jurisdiction over the proceeds of the sale. And add my client's share back into the estate to offset other amounts that the court finds. Every decision in the case has been virtually against my client. And
your client would then have a right of appeal if you felt like the court ruled erroneously or contrary to law, correct? And there are remedies if you feel like the judge is, in fact, biased, to remove the judge, none of which, at any rate. Okay, continue on with your argument. I guess I don't really have a question.
Yeah. Sorry. Thank you, Your Honor. There's really not that much to the argument other than the rules do provide for a specific manner in which for things to be brought. My client would have a right to remove a judge that was appointed. My client would have a right to make arguments to the chief judge as to why consolidation were not appropriate. All of those rights are just being taken away, and we're just throwing the rules by the side for the sake of convenience. And while it may be in many cases that the one has good reason to stipulate to allow things to proceed in a different way, that's wasn't my client's interest in this case. So I see that I have 55 seconds left. I can see that the court understands the issues, and there's the additional issues which with respect to the amended findings, which are covered in the brief. And unless the court has questions about those, I wouldn't address those further. And I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel. And yes, you can, you took up your time in questioning. You can raise what you would like in your remaining 5 minutes on rebuttal too. That's fine. Counsel for respondent, we're ready for you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Teresa Mohabir, and I'm here on behalf of respondent concern, Lily Karolik. Your Honors, I have three main points that I would like to discuss today. The first point that I would like to make is that one of the major motivations behind this appeal by appellant is to blatantly judge shop due to her perceiving Judge Fountain Lindberg as a threat to her devious and underhanded scheme to misappropriate her mother's assets. The second point is that the probate division is indeed the proper forum to have this partition action heard for numerous reasons, including the fact that appellant herself has previously availed herself of the jurisdiction of the probate court with respect to her divided interest in the family home. As a result, she's waived any argument to regarding subject matter jurisdiction, and she's now a stop from challenging the trial court's jurisdiction with regard to the partition matter. Finally, the third point that I would like to...
Just with respect to that, the way I understand the way this is proceeded, although there seemed to be initial argument about district court versus probate court, I felt like that issue had been resolved, that both parties agree that the district court is the proper court for resolution of this. Is there something I'm missing there?
I think we were never really sure if they had conceded that or not. I mean, so on January 17, 2017, at the commencement of the guardianship and conservatorship proceeding, the appellant herself appeared with counsel and asked the court to exercise jurisdiction over this exact divided property interest that she's now claiming that the probate court doesn't have proper jurisdiction over. And you know, the only reason that we, and you know, I wasn't involved in that, that initial hearing, but, you know, it's our assumption is that the reason she asked the probate court to exercise jurisdiction over that property is because the transfer of that interest to her, that 50% interest as a tenant in common, was done under suspicious circumstances. And she was, likely concerned that it would come under scrutiny. So in the initial settlement discussions between the two sisters, you know, as Attorney Lesher has said multiple times, it's been contentious since day one. But that was one of the concessions that my client made to come to an agreement where she could be the conservator. At that time, they were co-guardians, was that that transfer wouldn't be challenged, you know, and therefore the probate court has already exercised jurisdiction over Helen Karolik's interest.
Although that's a different proceeding than a partition proceeding.
Correct.
I just wanted, so what you're arguing that the waiver occurred prior to the service and initiation of the complaint for petition.
Correct.
And that waived to have the jurisdiction, no objections to the partition action.
Yes, because I mean, it seems like their argument is that I guess I understood the argument to be that the the probate division isn't the proper place to have the partition action heard because the interest in the family home are divided interests as opposed to an undivided interest. And, the Minnesota rule of civil procedure, rule one, you know, is to secure the just, speedy, and inexpensive determination of every action. You know, this property has come into control of my client, who is the conservator, under the laws of Minnesota. They bring the court's attention to statute 524.1-302A, but section B of that statute, you know, the court has full power to make orders, judgments, and decrees and take all other action necessary and proper to administer justice in the matters which come before it. And this matter is properly before the court.
I understand Mr. Letcher's argument. He can certainly clarify if I am wrong or others, but he's not challenging the court's authority to decide this matter. He's saying procedurally, this was not done correctly. And therefore, with respect to the partition action individually, it has to be filed separately, not within an existing case file. And then things go from there because that gives his client certain rights from the outset. And ultimately, it could be consolidated. It may not be, but it's important that this occur procedurally correctly. So if that's a restatement of his argument, in essence, I mean, other than it's another expense for the your client, and there is some time involved, of course, why is that not an appropriate remedy?
Because for the expense, Your Honor, you know, the estate is already running out of money. You know, this is a major asset of the estate. And then also the timeliness. I mean, you know, from the beginning of the commencement of these proceedings, the appellant has utilized scorched earth tactics to try to delay and exhaust and lay waste to Olga Kuralik's estate. And, you know, we feel very strongly that this is an attempt to judge shop. You know, as Mr. Lesher pointed out, you know, they've improperly filed a motion to disqualify Judge Fountain-Lindberg. Basically, they're doing everything in their power to evade Judge Fountain-Lindberg's courtroom because she feels threatened by Judge Fountain-Lindberg. And, you know, quite frankly, it has been an extremely long proceeding. It's been extremely contentious. It's very important for expense and for justice and for timeliness to have this heard before Judge Fountain-Lindberg, who understands the case, who, you know, understands many of the devious tactics that they've done. I mean, they've...
That would be your argument for consolidation. And, you know, they can, of course, come in with whatever opposition they have to that, and you can raise all of these points that you feel like it's judge shopping to not consolidate and so forth. But it seems like those same arguments could be expressed in that way through that vehicle.
It seems to me as though that going through that tortured procedure of a second filing fee of duplicative and expensive filings and motions is exactly what flies in the face of the idea behind the consolidation of the courts in the first place. I mean, the whole idea of consolidating them is to, eliminate, you know, this kind of just tortured procedure.
If this was not, if the objection was not waived, let's assume that for purposes of argument, what is the affirmative authorization for bringing this partition action within the existing action? Are you arguing that it's within the authority of the probate authority of the district court?
We are, Your Honor. A combination of the statutes 524.1-302 and 524.5-106, and then also 524.1-201, you know, the definition of estate includes all of the property of decedent, trust, or other person whose affairs are subject to this chapter. You know, this property is within the jurisdiction of the probate court because it's part of Olga Kralik's estate. And the probate court, you know, is charged with protecting Olga Kralik's estate.
So if there had been a different third party who was a co-owner of this property, you know, I don't know who that might be, but just some investor or something, you're arguing that could be brought within against that other third party within this action in the way that it was brought?
Correct. Yes, Your Honor. You know, in the, you know, the case that the district court relied heavily upon, and read the matter of RIJ revocable trust agreement, I mean, that's exactly what happened. I mean, it was a trust, but it was a third, you know, it was a third party. You know, in this case, you know, given that Helen Kralik has been a party to this action, you know, she's an interested party, and you know, she's previously asked the court to exercise subject matter jurisdiction over this property. It's has a much closer nexus to the probate court than the situation in the RIJ trust agreement case.
So can I, looking at 524.5106, where it talks about what the court has jurisdiction over. And there's the phrase at the near the end of that saying, and property coming into the control of a guardian or conservator who is subject to the laws of this state. So with a tenancy as in common, is that property coming into the control of a guardian or conservator?
Yeah. So from the beginning of this conservatorship, my client as conservator has paid all of the property taxes on both halves of the property. She's paid it as a whole. She's paid for the property insurance. She's paid for the sewer, the water, the electricity. She has been the one to meet the fire marshal from Columbia Heights, given that the property has been deemed to be uninhabitable due to the appellant's hoarding habits. She has certainly exercised control over the property as a whole. The final point that I would like to make is that the appellant, and I guess this is in regard to both the issue regarding the third annual accounting and then also somewhat with respect to, you know, the partition action. You know, the appellant's propensity to complain about estate expenses, she's doing everything in her power to increase the very expenses that she's complaining about. And Your Honors, that's irresponsible. You know, throughout the pendency of the conservatorship, the appellant has continued her harassment of respondent with petty and frivolous filings that drive up attorney's fees, they drive up court fees, and it's resulting in exorbitant and unnecessary expenses to Olga Kralik's estate. And the only possible reason for these ongoing scorched earth tactics is a motivation by appellant to protect her ongoing scheme to misappropriate her mother's assets. And at present, that's her efforts to frustrate this partition action. It's completely irresponsible for the appellant to complain about spending estate fees on attorney's fees and associated conservator travel when she's filed a motion for amended findings, a formal appeal, to argue about a few thousand dollars in an insurance check from an account that was fully funded by Olga Koralik. She's complaining about the cost of companion home care services provided to her mother during a global pandemic when people off the street weren't allowed to go into the facility. And she's also complaining about the minimal cost of an order of protection for respondent that resulted from a vicious attack by appellant Helen Koralik on conservator Lily Koralik when she was in the family home exercising her conservatorship duties. And therefore, Your Honors, the decisions of the trial court are fully supported and proper, and this matter must be affirmed in its entirety. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. And I will be brief, probably more brief than the 5 minutes, but just to briefly address some of the issues with respect to waiver. I don't think that you can find a waiver back in 2017 when the sole stipulation was that essentially that Helen's interest in the home would not be affected by the case. I don't see how that becomes a stipulation that the court then has jurisdiction to determine how that interest will be handled. With respect to counsel quoted 524.1-302, and that brings up that again the point that the court has the power to administer things that the statutes provide it has jurisdiction of and which are properly brought before it. So matters which come before it, there's a way that we bring a matter before a court, and that did not happen here, and therefore the court can't exercise jurisdiction. Judge Hallbrooks, Your Honor, I think you did accurately summarize what the essential argument is, and like I said, it's not highly complicated. And so it is what it is. This, especially in a probate court, is a highly form-based practice where things are expected to go a certain way, and as opposed to civil litigation where there's a lot more gray area, and to simply thrust a partition action into a guardian and conservatorship case under the probate code without following the proper procedures would be an invitation for a lot of chaos in the courts as people sought to bring inappropriate matters directly into cases, and it would just create a lot more work and uncertainty for the courts. So I don't think there's, and again, we're talking about subject matter jurisdiction here, so we can't create what doesn't exist, and it doesn't exist here. A couple comments which are probably not relevant, but which I don't want to appear to have conceded as far as, for example, the suspicious circumstances under which, my client received the 1/2 interest. My client lived with her mother and took care of her long before she was deemed to be vulnerable, for I think more than a decade. And the transfer to Helen was long before any finding of vulnerability. So I just want to make it clear that I think the reason why the stipulation was made that Helen's interests wouldn't be affected was an acknowledgement of that fact. And then there were some other comments, which I'm not going to get into, but just to note as far as descriptions of things, the record will speak for itself as, to the relationship between the parties. So unless there are further questions, I'd simply request that the court vacate, or I guess I should be clear, to reverse the trial court's decision to accept jurisdiction and grant and deny the motion to strike and to strike all of the filed pleadings so that if a partition action is the desired remedy here, that it can be commenced in the proper way and go through the channels the correct way. And then, as I already indicated, with respect to the factual findings, I think the briefing covered what our issues are with the propriety of those findings. And I understand the tough burden that we have to overturn those, but do submit that on the briefing. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much, counsel. Thank you both for your arguments, your briefing. Case is submitted. We'll have a decision.